I don't want to stereotype myself that I should put like Buddha and bamboo on the wall because I'm a Vietnamese restaurant. My house in Vietnam was from the 70s, so it's kind of modern building, modernism. For me, Slanador is really about bringing a piece of Vietnam to you and perfecting the craft, right? I remember eating bò lục lạc in Saigon in 1992. You know, it was something I didn't have as a kid. And I just knew the only difference is I knew American would not want to overcook beef, right? They want a medium rare. And I was just looking for cheap meat to buy. Back then, these butcher houses would make these fillets for airline. They have a medallion. So a fillet have a head and a tail, and they can't really use a tail. And I was paying like $1 a pound, you know, $1 a pound, and it's 100% yield, so it's all clean. And I cut little pieces. I use the same recipe, and the rest is history. Charles Phan, the guy who started Slanador, founder, we have the Slanador Group, a few restaurants in San Francisco, California.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Well, first of all, thank you. Super happy to be here. I don't get to interview by Vietnamese very often. I should reach out to more Vietnamese people. Obviously, Vietnamese is very dear to me. I was born there, you know, and left in 75 on a boat and came to the U.S. Here I am, still cooking.
Yep. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you today?
Super proud, but also feel like there's is a responsibility to promote our culture, our people. I guess I always had a little chip on my shoulder, how people see us and how people see just Asian in general, our the food, aesthetic, our design. So Slanador was really born from all that observation.
During the time that you grew up in Dalat, you weren't thinking about becoming a food person.
No, I think about food a lot, but I wasn't thinking about food person. You know, we were not allowed to be on the street as the war got tougher and dad started making some money. So I was locked up and I would load these baskets for the street vendor to buy food. And all I remember about Vietnam is food. I never thought of want to be a chef. I do know I'm bad at school. I do know I'm bad at reading and writing. It doesn't matter what language we're talking about. So obviously I'm bad in English, but in Vietnamese, I'm just as bad. I think my dad like sent me to tutor both Vietnamese and Chinese. And as you know, in Vietnam, they have a ranking system. There's 60 kids, I remember. And I never made past 35. So I'm like on the bottom 50 percentile. And even though I got all the tutor, but I love to draw. I love to make things with my hand. And I remember in Dalat, it was a lot of craft, you know, because there's a tourist, you know, kind of like Tahoe light. And they would have these little pine tree, they carve in it, or they make balsa wood and cut a little figurine and, you know, Daffy Ducks on there and you sell them to the tourists. I love that stuff. I love making things, what's brought. There weren't a lot of toy and we would make stuff. And finally, I think one of us got chicken pox and we were locked up and my mom bought me a metal airplane. And by the time I finished chicken pox, the airplane is completely disassembled. I like to take stuff apart. And then I have a little motor with the battery operating. I was making something else with that.
So it's hard for me to kind of accept the fact that you didn't do well in school. So how did that all work out?
I think some of us just really less disciplined. If something I don't like, I just don't do. And in fact, I never graduated from Berkeley because I have a few more classes like math 1A and physic 1A. I never took because I hate those classes. But my architectural classes, all I aced those out. So I think, you know, I think that's just how most people are built. You know, we all kind of have our bandwidth and what we're interested in. And I think it's the most important thing. I have three kids, and I pray to God my son is interested in something. I got into Berkeley in 1982. My mom had fixed my age in Vietnam, so I'm in the military. So on paper, I was 2 years younger. That gave me a little heads up. So I came into Guam at sixth grade. So I tried to catch up in English. And I got into Berkeley. And I started working in a restaurant, and I was different. You know, Chinatown was rough. You know, there were a lot of gang. And the people that from Chinatown, the local, wasn't very nice to the immigrant, you know, of our own people. So, you know, San Francisco at the time, I was bused to the Mission District, and it was very mixed crowd, you know, and literally you have every ethnic group fighting, whatever the flavor of the day is between the Filipino and the Mexican. And next day is the Chinese against the Black. Oh, it's just like there's no one dominant group, you know, and everybody was poor. So there's a one common denominator. But when I got to Berkeley, that's when I really felt like, oh my God, like this is so different. These people are wealthier. They didn't think differently. So that's when I started feeling a little bit more oppressed when I was in Berkeley. You know, in San Francisco, I just feel like, well, you know, the ABC, yeah, the American born Chinese. I'm not sure if that's a bad word, but they weren't very nice because you know, you have to imagine the 70s, you don't have the right shoes and right clothing, then you don't fit in. So you always had the minority kid hang around. Then I got to Berkeley. That's I just continued working in a restaurant. I want to be an artist. I was studying ceramic. I did a lot of ceramic work. I was going to go to art school. Then, you know, Mission High was rough, you know, and I remember would find out these application for these competition in a trash can because the teacher doesn't even believe anybody's going to use it. So often I would enter these competitions by myself. So I was always self-starting. I remember did an AA competition in my senior year, and it was due the next day. It was prom night, so I was building my model in a tuxedo after my. So I think I always wanted to do design, and I settled architecture because Dad was very upset that I wanted to be an artist. So I ended up getting into Berkeley. I really want to go to New York, and I was flirting with Cooper Union, you know, or St. John. I was the oldest kid, so I settled in Berkeley and left Chinatown, moved to a big co-op in Berkeley, Barrington Hall, and you know.
And you knew that architecture would be the path for you to kind of appease your dad?
Yeah, I mean, it would sound like like an engineering job, but I liked it, and Berkeley really transformed me. I was fortunate enough to get a professor, a guy named Joe Eschrick. He looked like Yoda, you know, like taking you around with a bunch of kids, and there's no homework. He just talked. And really just kind of set my ways of how I think about architecture and art, and really that major really helped me throughout my life of just breaking things down, solving problems, and looking at design, looking at proportion. And I've always been a visual person. But the food thing starting to, you know, I was not a normal kid, right? I was drinking espresso and eating croissant in high school. I would ride my bike from Chinatown to Mission, and I would drink espresso at Just Dessert. And back then they were popular, and read the New York Times before I go to school. You know, I would drink Calistoga water, and everybody drink soda. I was definitely not normal. And I think it's because I was brought up with really great food in Vietnam. I remember complaining about the butter in San Francisco because it didn't taste like the butter we had in Da Lat. As a kid, I used to run to the bakery, pick up fresh baguette and put French butter and sugar in for breakfast. Or the roast pork lady would come in front of the store and I'd get like a piece of roast pork, me and my dad, and soy sauce and baguette and roast pork for breakfast in the morning. So I grew up really good food. So it was kind of natural that when I went to the restaurant, I was just drawn to those things. And this is even before Starbucks. So I love coffee and constantly want to learn how to cook. And I remember always asking the chef and watching how they do stuff, but I never worked in the kitchen. But the idea was, so I knew about service. I knew about, and you know, and my dad's an entrepreneur, so I learned a lot from him. So, but it was really during those years in Berkeley, I was just really kind of annoyed the fact that, you know, most Asian kid, like people say something like, I should go to Evans Hall, which is the math major building. You know, and design wasn't in the forefront, and so all those years after college, I just saw a niche. I say, why can't Vietnamese food be in a beautiful environment, modern environment, with all the service and accoutrement, but the food should be classic Vietnamese food? And it was in my head as an observation. And also, that's a way to kind of want to show off to the world that, hey, Vietnamese people can design. But my main focus has always been on the design aspect of design and service.
Was there any seeds of the future of getting into the food business?
No, not really. I was, you know, got into activism. I was organizing protests. They increased the tuition from $200 to $400. I thought that was outrageous. So I got into that, and I didn't finish that year. I moved to New York, worked for an architectural firm. Then I came back and I helped my mom ran her sewing shop. Then I got into sewing shop, then designing clothes. And, you know, that's a whole nother podcast we should talk about, like the sewing shop in Chinatown and quote unquote sweatshop. And it was very bad. You know, these businesses will take advantage of these immigrant and the law, and nobody know what's going on. And so I did that from 1984 to 1992. And I grew the business, got a clothing store on College Avenue, and then I remember demoing software, and a venture capital firm, Dylan Reed, was giving our company about $3 million. And I was selling, you know, doing the Gulf War into the Pentagon of these, you know, titling software, you know, animation software. And, you know, that did it for 2 years, went belly up. But Sandor was in my head for about 10 years. So in 1994, I was about, you know, unemployed for about 8 months, and I was going to continue selling software. I was going to move to Brazil. I was selling internationally, really loved Brazil. Brazil feels like Vietnam, you know, it's just full of energy, full of people. And opt to not to do it and decide to open my restaurant. And I didn't think about restaurant when I first started. I was living in downtown Oakland, and I saw the Twin Tower Federal Building went up, and I would say, oh, perfect place to put a little coffee shop. And I think it's just that all that training is from my father, you know, my father being an entrepreneur, always looking at things like location. I remember in Chinatown, he saw, you know, Broadway, where all the pornography is, and Broadway separate the Italian and the Chinese, and no one had crossed Broadway yet. And there was one pornography store on the corner, and he said, that's not going to last. Like, he can see that magazine store, and he probably doesn't even know what pornography store is. And he went after it, and they didn't just give it to him because he didn't have the connection with the local. So they ended up buying a sewing shop and got conned. So, you know, really hard, just getting screwed over and over again. And all that, I can tell, you know, thousands of stories about what we went through in Chinatown in the early year. You know, it was rough, you know. One story I can tell you right now, the landlord didn't want to buy a lot of garbage can. So he didn't have a place to put garbage. So he went down the street and put it into some dumpster. Then one night we got this bang on the door because there's some address in there. There was a pile of garbage in our door. And the guy pulled out a gun and demanded $400. And mind you, that's the entire month paycheck. And we had to pay. And I still remember staying in it and just, you know, so, you know, so I'm back. Selling software, I'm done. I was going to do a little coffee shop in Oakland, and they say, nah, you don't have any experience, and you know, they don't want me to do that because I never had the, I didn't think I could cook, so I wasn't going to open a fancy restaurant. So I was like, all right. And I was in the Mission, and I try, you know, back then there weren't any Craigslist or wanted ads, so you would look in the paper. And for 8 months I was cooking with friends and looking at wanted ad every morning and have 3 hour coffee in the morning and look at recipe and cook that at night and really just had a time to really reflect and figure out what I want to do. And I was going to do a little bun sale shop in the Tenderloins, and this French guy said, nah, you got just too many Vietnamese here, we don't want you. You know, he was doing hostel for European, and I get it, right? Like he just tried to service his customer because like everybody else is Vietnamese around him. So yeah. Then I told him, hey, I can cook French food. So but he didn't buy it, so he didn't lease it to me. And it was just like a counter with 12 seat with, you know, 2-4 top. It was so small, and I thought it would be cool, I could just cook there. And you know, I was going to model after, you know, Betty Ocean Diner in Berkeley. So my brain's always kind of working and looking at business angle. And it doesn't, I just don't let the not knowing part scares me. I just say, I'll deal with it later. So we found this space. I found this space in Valencia Street, and it was in a restaurant. And I just figure, well, nobody wants this. I mean, other people wanted it, but I figure I can build it cheap since I have building construction experience. And not only I don't know how to cook, I never built a restaurant. So I just built it. Took me a year, credit card. And I would go down to the building department. And this one not so nice guy, he would just make one comment at a time, right? He would say, well, this is wrong. Then I come back with 2 weeks, and he said, why can't you just tell me, like, give me a couple more rounds so I don't come back here. But it took me a year, a bunch of credit card. And so November of 1995, we opened our door, you know. I mean, I literally just had 16 on the menu. Mom had this spring roll recipe. I knew it was a winner. But I was very clear on what the food was going to be because by the time I went to college from 1982 to 94, Mom would get us to come back home. She would make Vietnamese food. And even though we're in Chinatown, we're Chinese, but we're just like miss. Like she make bun bao. And I mean, even today, my kid loves it. And they call it circle noodle because they don't know how to speak Vietnamese. They call it circle noodle. And she would make hot bun bao, and you would assemble your plate yourself, or she'll have a spring roll station that you roll it yourself. And that was just, you know, she wasn't a chef, and she's actually a businesswoman more so than, because she was in charge of our family business and at the general store and selling sugar, selling gas, kerosene, that sort of thing. So she wasn't cooking. So I was hanging in the back with at the warehouse with the ladies that helped her. And later on, I was moved to live with my aunt in Saigon, and she was a great cook, and I watched her cook. And it's always kind of, But I pay attention. I just love it. And I didn't realize it was kind of in my head. And you got these things like do's and don't, which one come first. And you don't even question it just because that's how they do it. You know, you heat up the oil, then you wait the oil's hot, and you put the garlic down, then the onion. Like I knew, I was just so natural to me. I don't even think about it. And now I teach some young cook and they put the onion down and instead of the garlic first. And of course, if you do that, you're not going to brown your garlic because the onion's got too much water. So that's where I really developed, you know, all the little nuances. But once I start cooking in 95, I was on a roll. I was cooking lunch and dinner. I would go to the market with my truck. I was pick up everything every day. And because I don't have restaurant experience, I was just doing everything the hard way.
What was the name of that first restaurant?
Slanted Door.
Oh, you called it the Slanted Door.
Yeah, we, so a whole bunch of people getting drunk on my cooking. And I told them I opened the restaurant and people just thought I was crazy. And somebody said, instantly your door slanted. They went inside, but the whole wall was slanted. So that's how the name come about. You know, it's a 1950 retail store with a canted, you know, diagonal window front. I didn't want to call it a Vietnamese name. I was very conscious of how the stereotyping, even back then, I knew, like, I just instinctively knew how I want to present the story. I don't want you to be tainted and come. And we were doing everything different. We were doing expensive Chinese tea, charging $4 or $5, same price as my spring roll back then. And the Ritz-Carlton charged $2 a pot, and my tea was $4.50. And because I learned from this gentleman a few years before, they were importing really expensive Chinese tea. It was so amazing, and I can't afford to give it out for free. And customer would get upset. I was like, every Chinese restaurant give free tea. And I go, well, number one, I'm not a Chinese restaurant. So there you go. You're not getting free tea and you need to pay, but it's worth it, you know? And slowly that's how we win the customer over. And now, you know, nobody, people always ask, you know, where's the good tea? Where's the good tequila and bourbon? And the food world changed quite a bit, you know? When back then I served six fish, whole fish, and four of them come back, people upset, crying, because they thought they saw the head. And you know, now I serve, you know, 30 fish a night, and it's been few years that ever, it's been 10 years, no one ever sent anything back. You know?
Yeah. So I want to go back to the Slanted Door. The word slanted today comes with a punch. It's packed with some meaning. There's a band called the Slanted or the Slant, and it's a bunch of Asian guys. And at the time that you named it that, it sounds like it was from a canted door, right? But was there any kind of impression for you?
Oh, yeah. The race thing was right up there. And I was a little worried at first, but at the same time, I loved it, right? It's really just like, we're going to poke you in the eye and we're going to confront it, right? Like for me, at first, it was like, it's kind of cool, sound kind of cool, but also, oh my God, it's like borderline bad word, you know?
Yeah.
And I just, you know, trusted my instinct. I think, wow, this is good. This is good because it's kind of poking, it's kind of not. It's just depends. And if you're old enough, if you're old, like World War II veteran, then you see it as a race thing. But if you're young enough, you think it's Alice in Wonderland, everything's crooked, you know? The Mad Hatter is going to come out of it, right? So, but I purposely do not want you to think of Vietnamese. Then you start experiencing the fancy wine, the modern design. Then you experience Vietnamese. It's all purpose driven since day one, because like I don't want to stereotype myself that, you know, I should put like Buddha and bamboo on the wall because I'm a Vietnamese restaurant, right? That's not, you know, in fact, my house in Vietnam was from the 70s. So it's kind of modern, modernism. if you look at the presidential palace, when the tank runs through in 75, you know, a lot of those buildings from the 50s, 60s. So, so for me, it was important to have that juxtaposition. You know, I want to serve French dessert because I don't think the jet would work, you know? So initially I was going to do a simple, you know, kind of pho and bone place because I'm in a very poor neighborhood. But I couldn't help myself. By the time at night I started doing fancy dinner, I cut out all the bone and, you know, fancy wine, and it just took off.
How did you know that this is quality? How did you know in your mind that this is food that is just amazing to where you can build like a big following eventually?
Well, it's immediate feedback. I would run these special. I would come back, maybe pick up the produce at 10. I would go to lunch service, and I would, in between lunch and dinner, I would come up with a special. And I would put on the menu with a verbal, and I would have people taste it at 5 o'clock. It would be on the menu that night. And I would test it at home. I'll be the last guy to leave the restaurant. I wash the restaurant down. Because I have all that background, I know how to bus table. Like, I wasn't going to leave it to anybody. So I empty out my fryer every night. It's just, after 27 years, we never not empty a fryer. Filter it, even the dirty oil, you filter it, you wash your fryer. That's how you do it. And those first couple of years, like, I was just experimenting different things, and things, some are bad, you know. Like, I remember this one curry chicken, I was so embarrassed about it, you know. And years later, this guy's like, oh, I remember the place, best curry chicken ever. I was like, oh my God, like, this is so bad. And you know, to a high school, I would watch Jacques Pepin and Julia Child. I was interested in cooking. I cooked my first Thanksgiving dinner for my parent when we got to San Francisco in 1977 with a Wedgwood stove. It took me 3 or 4 days to make this complete turkey kitchen dinner because I wanted my family to assimilate to this culture. Oh. And my mom didn't trust me, so she had a pot of curry just in case that I screw up. So, you know, cooking was natural to me. I cook a lot, and mom had two jobs. I cook for the family.
Were there other Vietnamese restaurants competing at your level at that time?
No. I mean, for some crazy reason, just there's not a lot of Vietnamese restaurant period in San Francisco, you know. I think a lot of us moved down to San Jose, and mm-hmm. you know, if you follow the camp story, Camp Pendleton, which is further south, you know, by Carmel, Monterey. And yeah, a lot of people went into the semiconductor business, you know. There weren't a lot of Vietnamese here, mostly Chinese in Chinatown. And when we opened, was the review was really, they just never saw anything like it. You know, I made all the table with plywood, cheap, you know, but I spend money on the chair because I built everything, you know. I laid the floor, I laid the tile, you know, enough credit card just to buy half the tile, and custom-made railing, like wherever we could do it, we were doing it. And I have a terrible carpentry skill, so these benches doesn't line up, so I put a little metal band on it, like Louis Vuitton or something, mm-hmm. to cover up my mistake. And we just make it happen. And, you know, on a hot day, the air conditioning was so bad that I just climb on the roof and open up all the skylight. In the wintertime, it's so cold at 5 o'clock, 5:30. And I say, I'll bring you tea. Within an hour, the restaurant fills up and the body heat just heat up the restaurant because we didn't really have heat in our restaurant. You know, and we keep doing it and changing. Then we lost our lease. We had to go. Then we went to Brennan Street for 2 years. Also, it was like back to this whole refugee thing, right? I got nowhere to go. I had to leave the space I have, and you know, the landlord was squabbling with family internal. I couldn't stay. Then I convinced them to sell the building. Then I had to fix it to come back. So I moved temporary. I literally just said, all right, I'm just going to move her restaurant down to Embarcadero. And this restaurant had went out of business. And I bring a walk-in. I just use it as is. And we move in. And I even make my staff be the mover. And within a week, we got a restaurant in the by the ballpark, you know? And it took off. And I was like, oh my God. And people doesn't complain about, you know, $9 Pinot. I mean, in Valencia Street, people bitch about the $9 Pinot. I was like, great, this is, you make more money here. People who can sell more expensive things. And then we lost a lease again. You know, we lost a lease. We thought we were going to stay. For some reason, this guy just canceled, you know. So I got nowhere to go again. So and, you know, and Ferry Building had talked to me about some noodle shop. And it took me 4 days. I settled down and I went to the Ferry Building. I was like, all right, I'm going to take this space. But you have 48 out and say yes to everything I want. So,
oh shit. So you had the chips.
Well, I didn't, but I was so frustrated with negotiating the other deal for 6 months and nothing gets done. And I got like I didn't really have a home. And we, you know, we were busy, you know, and no one, this is the .com had crashed. Nobody wants this restaurant. The Ferry Building sites were going to be 2 restaurants. And I told him, I was like, I'm ready to do it. And so we got the deal done. And I opened in 10 months from the time I shake the guy's hand, not the lease, just the LOI. Normally it takes 2 or 3 months just to get the lease signed. But we did everything in 10 months and the Ferry Building just changed the whole course. Yeah. That year, 2004, I won the James Beard Award for the Best Chef California. Things start, you know, we were definitely, people were just in love with the restaurant for whatever reason.
Do you think that when you got to the Ferry Building, your game increased?
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Increased in your awareness and your taste and your viewpoints, everything just like jumped up? Or is it just sort of like this, you know, you just did your time in grade, time in service, and you know, you just got better, and you know.
No, we were like a hole in the wall place, right? So people loved that. People still love that. Like it was just really holding the place. Got no place to move. I used to have burn mark in my arm because there was so little room. You turn around with a hot pan, and we moved to Brennan Street, but it was somebody else's restaurant. It was fine. People loved the food. But Ferry Building, that's when I met Ole Lundberg. Now we become best of friends, and he designed a really modern restaurant. And you didn't see a lot of that at the time. And I got a lot of heat from veteran people, you know, telling me, oh, this is too cold, too modern. But it was the first time we have a big build out, expensive build out. The landlord gave us money. And it was my luck, too, because when I got there, everybody wanted the south side because that's the side that have the more wealthy people getting on the boat, right? You know, back to the boat thing. So the ferry boat on the right-hand side, the south side is Sausalito. And the left-hand side is the poor people going to Vallejo. So nobody wants the left-hand side, right? And it turns out left-hand side is the best view because it didn't have this big building blocking the bridge. So I just got lucked out, just got opened up with the view. And it just took off right away. And it was crazy, you know.
How big was it? How many seats was?
So the first restaurant was like, you know, it's supposed to be 50 seat, but we crammed like 90 seat people in there. Then the second one was about 150. Then the Ferry Building was 200. Yeah, it's like 220. Yeah, but it was really the first time we built everything from scratch, and Ollie had not done a restaurant before, and it was just one of the best projects he and I did. You know, the table was custom made. We found these wood from the Cypress freeway collapsing, and we were just so, you know, I you know, by then everybody knew I was doing a restaurant. All these resumes coming in, and people saying, you know, they would highlight their portfolio and they tear out, they highlight the Buddha and say, I do a fusion restaurant. I mean, for me, fusion restaurant is like F word for me, right? I was like, dude, I love your restaurant. I've been there for a year. I was like, you're an idiot. If you've been in my restaurant a year, you know I don't like this stuff. And when I met Oli and I say, how are you going to do my restaurant? He said, well, you take simple thing and you make it beautiful. And that's what I'm going to do to your restaurant. I'm going to make simple materials. I'm going to be beautiful. And I was like, dude, this is my guy. And I said to him, if I can afford it, I would love to work with you. He said, don't worry about that. And we sketch out the next meeting. We sketch out a plan like about an hour. And we just went running from there. And you know, we just really bonded. And we just see a lot of things the same way. And he's an avid cook, amazing architect. And for me, it's really about, it's been the same thing I've been trying to say for a long time, you know, like regardless your ethnicity, right? When you build something, you have to bring something new to the table and stand above, you know, people are going to judge you on everything for quality, ingenuity, and all design. It's no different than a Vietnamese restaurant, you know, so by then I was a little bit more confident. But I knew from the architectural and service side, you know, I was onto something. You know, we were really early on serving food family style. And we were doing a lot of things new, like no one was doing. It wasn't just the food, right? So in 1995, I marked a gentleman doing my wine list. He was doing all the Italian and Chardonnay. He realized no good. And he switched to Riesling. We become the Riesling king. You know, we just don't brag about it. And people know that we were doing all this stuff, regardless of whether I'm Vietnamese or not. But I was just in the trenches and I hired the right people. I don't know why. So I just inspired them to say, look, you got to be like me with Vietnamese food, whatever you do, just, you know. And I remember I moved to the Ferry Building, Brandon Street, and I met Dad, a voyeur from Bar Agricole. He was running my bar. You know, this traditional, you know, when I was in high school, you would do like pre-mixed margarita mix and all this crap, right? And I went to him, I said, I know how to do that, but can we just go back to the original, like what I do to my food? And he made me the first margarita. And I was like, oh my God, margarita. And back then he was so crazy that he wanted to squeeze the lime one at a time so the oil would permeate above your glass. Right. And you know, we become craft cocktail. We were doing that before all, you know, all these people with suspender and whisker doing that right now. Right. But we were doing that like literally in 2000, you know, year 2000, yeah. We were doing that because, you know, we wanted to really buy good ingredients. We had three bourbon, three gin. It was all blind tasting, very democratic. Our well bourbon was Pappy. I don't know, you don't know anything about Pappy, but Pappy bourbon is just most sought after bourbon in the country. Like you get a bottle of minimum $600. But in 2004, he was a nobody. I haven't won any war. I can get him a $20. Mm-hmm. And I was serving that with ginger ale down the drain, right? And we were ahead of the game all the time.
Amazing. You went back to Vietnam in 92, and subsequently, did you go back often, or the restaurant was just taking too much of your time?
No, my wife's from Thailand, so we were going back every year with the kid, and I always make a stop in Vietnam. I pretty much go every year. I was consulting in Japan, and even 5 hours to go back to Vietnam, that's even I'm there, like the last trip in 2018, I went to Vietnam for 2 days to learn how to make banh mi. I was trying to track this guy down, and I didn't realize from Japan to Ho Chi Minh City is 5 hour plane ride. I love it because if I go back now, I can really understand, go to places like Hoi An and, to eat these dishes that are, how do you know what mei guang is? Maybe you don't eat 10 of them, right? Mei guang could be anything. Mei guang could be mei guang from different guys. So you can't just eat once. You literally have to eat 10 or 15 mei guang to figure out what is really, I call it the water table for all these things. And Vietnam's are changing too. And during the war, I'm from Dalat, so we didn't really go a whole lot of places. And now, the food from the Delta is really interesting. I don't go there enough. And I do go.
As the modern world is continuing, we are losing all of these recipes. So I really appreciate that ability for you to capture the senses of it and then retell it in the modern world.
I used to buy these clay pot. I love clay pot from China, and they're small industry, making beautiful things by hand. They're not, just machine made and stupid decal with the same color. And over the year, as the Chinese economy grow, it doesn't make sense for them to make these artisan things. Right. So they got to make thousands of, so even that, like their own culture, they're squashing it. There's no, it's all about making money. It's not about like the old way of making craftsmanship. It's sad. And I'm sure this will turn around someday, and there will be more artisan people making clay pot and so on. But yeah.
That's the beautiful part of like the Japanese though, right? The Japanese somehow were like, okay, money is relative, but let's get the craftsmanship continuing for 100, 300, 400 years. They have companies that last 900 years in Japan. It's crazy.
Yeah. I do a lot of work in Japan, and I just can't understand how the amount of sacrifice they're willing to do of their, craft. Me and my son was just looking at Google, and there have 150 million people living in Japan, and there's 39 million people living in California. So that's a lot of people in that little place, right? Mm-hmm. And yes, these tradition, not to say that Japanese don't do bad thing. There's a lot of bad ceramic out there, but at the same time, yes, they are fanatic about their craft and craftsmanship and so on. And I think, slowly, like any culture, if you look at the Italian in the beginning, you got, checker cloth table, and as they make more money, they have fancier Italian restaurant, and you're going to see all that influx of more people paying attention. I think for the first time, I start seeing a lot of young chef, really believe in their culture and try to expand that, right? They don't do it like me, just old school. They want to expand that, but yet they don't just, just cooking French and, for a long time, that's what they all aspire to do, go learn how to cook French food. And Asian, it was always like not considered the high end stuff, but now they're not. And a lot of American chefs learn how to cook Japanese way, and a lot of people now want to cook Vietnamese way.
Can I ask you about that pricing? Why is our cuisine, Vietnamese cuisine, not priced up there yet?
Well, if you look at my price, it's pretty high.
Yeah, I mean, you're the exception, right? I mean,
like any business, right? Regardless your race, pricing, it's always never ending. Try to figure out the glass ceiling. So, I mean, it's not just race, you know, but there's a lot of stereotype what things should cost.
Right? Why do you think you broke free from that glass ceiling?
Because if you present the quality and you take the time to explain to them and you got everything else to back it up with, in other words, the service, the wine, the fancy table, they say, okay, I'm paying for the glassware, I'm paying for the service, right? But I'll give you an example. Shaking beef, it's half a pound of filet. I was telling you $1 a pound, that was a long time ago. Today, I pay $16, you know, with a 28% waste. So it's a lot, you know. So by the time I'm done with it, my cost is like close to $20 before I can sell it to you. So I'm selling it at $45, right? That's a half a pound of filet. Now you go to a fancy steakhouse, that steak could be half a pound, could be $75. It's all perception because now they see steakhouse, they just think that they're gonna spend a lot of money. So you got a little bit of that. But yes, because we have a lot of prejudice towards pricing, what we think it should be. But that thing is changing, you know, like Japanese food, nobody said Japanese food, like the first thing you can come out of your mouth is going to be expensive.
Nobody blinks.
You know? Yeah, because you probably don't want to eat $1 sushi anyways. God knows where that come from, right? Like if I'm telling you all sushi is like $1 a piece, it's like, Lord, where does this come from, right? Like, you're not going to eat that. You give it for me free. I'm just going to look at it. So pricing, it's a... I don't want to blame everything on the race. Definitely people do, you know. But what I saw over the year, so I served sandwich for $16 bun meat, right? But the comment was like, a little high for a sandwich because they're not... They used to pay $5 sandwich, you know, $5 Subway, whatever, right? But all the comment below that, like you see Vietnamese people, oh my God, it's the best sandwich I ever had, best bun mi, and he makes his own ja, he makes his own pate. I literally make my own pate, my ja, my chicken liver mousse. I make my own mayonnaise. Like I literally make everything for that sandwich, right? I mean, then you just know that you're paying for a premium product, right? So you know, you could go to Lee Sandwich, it's just like a regular product. I'm a premium set, you know. Yeah. So I'm not a luxury, I don't have a $90 sandwich yet. Maybe someday I would have a $90 sandwich.
When are you opening up at the Ferry Building?
Hopefully by the end of, probably in the spring, you know, major construction. You know, the business, you know, the restaurant business has been really hard. The staffing issue, cost of good. And,
do you think all of that will return to the old days?
You know, it's the old day is not exactly good either. You know, we have.
I'm glad you said that.
You know, we were doing a lot of
mistake.
It was a lot of volume, like, but. You know, the staffing, the pay rate. We'll need another podcast to talk about money and staffing in front of the house, back of the house. But COVID changed that, right? Now we charge 20% service charge, right? We tell them, it's like, look, like we need to, you know, in my sandwich shop, I put a 20% on there because I want to pay my sandwich maker a tip. And part of that is living wage. It's just different how you calculate it, right? Like it's just, you cannot make 15, 16, 18 bucks an hour minimum wage and live in the city. I don't care how poor you are. Like that's not even it's not There's doable. No option, so the tip had gone up because people adding a little bit more. It's because the law in California doesn't allow you to pay the front of the house, back of the house, all this screwed up. So now we go to the service charge that allow me to dictate where the money go. We'll take a little bit of money out of the waiter. It's hard because the waiter used to make a certain amount of money as much as they want to change, you know, but just finding that balance, finding a balance and people start accepting things going to cost a certain amount. And with the inflation, that changes this whole thing. It's crazy. Yeah. So it's hard to say, but I think that I hope that, you know, at some point, you know, people can't really work from home anymore. They need to go back to work so that you will have happy hour. Right now, we don't have happy hour. There's no happy anywhere because they work from home and they get sick of homes. So they travel like crazy on the weekend, go to Napa, go to the country and have staycation. And hopefully, you know, we get back to our normalcy, that little balance, you know, maybe you stay home one day a week. I'm not suggesting you just come to work every day and go back to the traffic, you know, but at the same time, you know, this industry is one of the few unlucky industry, you know, that we got hit the most. This is the only business got shut down. Well, not only business, but it got shut down, right?
One of the first, yeah.
Yeah, and if you in tech, you still can work. You're allowed to work. We can't work. We're exposed to all these disease because we have to go out and we're not getting paid. It was less money. Right now, every restaurant is 20-30% down because nobody goes out after 8 o'clock. So, but you can't rush these things. People do what they do. It tells you how fragile the whole system is and how people, you know, you change their pattern. It's very hard to get them back to a certain other pattern. But you know, I'm just like a refugee and I'm just going to keep trekking until I can't trek anymore.
I feel like we only had several touch points that I wanted to go deeper into, but I know that I have like a lot of things that I want to hear from you. And I'm glad that, you know, that you have so much to say, and I didn't get to ask, you know, 70% of my questions, but I got a real good picture. And, you know, I think the audience gets a real wide base of who you are, and then coming back year after year to talk about different developments in the food industry is something that I'm wildly fascinated about.
Yeah, thank you. I'd love to come back, and I really need to understand and learn more about our people, you know, the Vietnamese community, because obviously, you know, we're not monolithic, and we're just so many of us in different places. And I remember I was doing a campaign ad during Trump administration. This one group asked me to do a kind of anti-Trump ad. It was so interesting. I don't remember seeing the January 6th insurrection. I see all these Vietnamese flags. And I was like, what was that? I was like, I thought I was seeing double, you know, there was some like Arizona flag with a little snake. And then the Vietnamese flag was just as big and run across there. And I was like, holy moly, what's going on here? Like, you know, and it's interesting to really understand why that stuff is happening. It's interesting because
it is.
And we are, you know, I don't want to hear them make a lot of judgment about those things, but I think, at least for ourselves, to really understand where all that stuff is coming from, you know?
And, yeah, we're not a monolith. You're right. And even within the Republican or the Democrat parties, they're very different. That people that exist, there's different shades and different nuances of people. And I don't like it when, you know, the progressives or the conservatives take a harsh stance like the way the American political system is turning out to be. We have to see things for all of the different little nuances, that whether it's Vietnamese in Vietnam or Vietnamese in Germany or Vietnamese in America or Vietnamese Trump supporters, Vietnamese Biden supporters, there's so many different variations of who we are. And I think exploring by conversation, the more we talk, long form podcast is everything, because we get to really experience each other and other people get to experience who Charles Fatten is. And
my dad refused to go back to Vietnam. You know, like he passed away. He hated what had happened to him in Vietnam. He would never step foot back in Vietnam since 75. And we had a lot of opportunity to take him back. And he was so bitter about the whole thing, about losses, his business and home. And I find it really fascinating. You know, now I'm older, I just turned 60, and try to imagine what it was like when he was 42 when he left, I think he's 40 something. No. He was 50 years old when in 75, something like that. And how my mom, like at her age, she went back to the house, right? After we found the boat to leave, and she went and grabbed all the baby formula, you know, to bring on the boat. I was just like, genius, right? I mean, I don't think this woman even had an education. And for her to go back to the giant warehouse, we got wine, booze, and everything. She grabbed some clothes, all the baby formula. She put it in a bag, right? She emptied it out so people can't rob her, lose powder. Like, you know, put it in a plastic bag and a couple, you know, sausages. And that powder was our only bargaining thing on the boat. On that boat, nobody wants your money. The money they were throwing overboard, because that money is no good, right? And you can have all the gold you can. And nobody we would give some powder to get to use a pot to boil the water. And they were just like, it just gave chill to my bone, you know. First year back to Vietnam, I saw that yellow can and the, you know, at a antique store. I bought it and I treasured it, right? It was the same can that she bought, this baby formula, you know? I was like, I mean, it seems like she'd been camping before or something. I'm sure she'd never been camping before. her brain, and that's how it's amazing. When she's calm, and I think like I see this in and out again from my family, my aunt, my mom, you know? Because a lot of men are not in the picture. They're in the jungle. My uncle, he's part of the CIA. He's always touring. And, you know, my aunt, you know, cooked for me a little bit. And she would get on her motorbike, little Yamaha, raincoat, selling cigarette in Laba, you know. It's just there. Yeah, it's amazing. If you actually come back and you kind of judge them right now, just on the surface, like, you never went to school. You probably don't have internet, probably had no TV. You just everyday survival. And she just got it down. She got it down to all these ways. And I don't even know how my dad find an apartment in Chinatown. We got here in the Tenderloin, like, you know, we got in the Tenderloin. We lived in two studio. And the next thing you know, the apartment manager set the building on fire, and then we lost a bunch of stuff. Like, it wasn't just the Vietnam War, you know. We got to Guam, we lived for a year, then the typhoon Pamela came and blew our house away. We're back into the Red Cross line. and you know, and yeah, these stories just, you know, but it didn't stop them at all. Like, they didn't, was ever bitter. I don't think I ever see them. I'm sure they mess them up bad.
And you know, listening to these stories, I worry less about my children now, because, you know, no matter how hard they get it, it'll never be as hard as our parents. It's just impossible for that. Yeah. I would love to have you back on in the spring. You know, when I know it's going to be busy for you to reopen and everything, but, you find some time, we'll get back on. And, you know, I really appreciate you coming on today. And I was really looking forward to it. And I'm so glad that we had a chance to sit and talk.
I enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. And we shall continue.
Thanks, Charles. And hopefully maybe a Sundance thing that we talked about, you know, earlier this year, and, you know, get the party out there.
Sounds good. I love a party. All right.
Thank you,
ciao.
Charles. All right. Have a great one.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.